This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, how Alice's restaurant became a Thanksgiving song.
And Thanksgiving is nothing if not about tradition.
Plus, how to have a productive conversation around the table.
The stronger your facts are, the more they might backfire when you're trying to convince someone who thinks differently.
And what areas are included when we say Northern Colorado?
Yeah, I think people like to belong to an area.
That's coming up.
It's Wednesday, November 27th. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your look at news from around the state. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Last week, Fort Collins-based New Belgium Brewing, the fourth largest craft brewery in the U.S., announced its sale to Lion Little World Beverages, a multinational beverage company.
This came after an announcement earlier this month from Molson Coors that they would relocate their headquarters out of Colorado to Chicago, and the news in October that Boulder Beer would stop distribution outside of its brick-and-mortar brew pub. With all this recent beer news, we wanted to get a better handle on what's going on in the Colorado beer industry. To help us do just that, we're joined by Dan Micah, a reporter with Biz West. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Henry.
Let's start with New Belgium. What can you tell us about the sale?
There's not a lot about the financial side of this deal that we know quite yet. I've reached out to New Belgium. They said that they are not releasing the specifics of this deal. Of course, what we do know is that New Belgium has agreed last week to sell itself to a subsidiary of Japanese beverage company Kirin. They don't plan to lay anyone off or to lose any jobs, and they plan to have a vote probably sometime within the end of the year for the employee shareholders of the company to vote on whether the company can be sold or not. So really, that's all we know. We don't know anything about the valuation that New Belgium was looking at. We don't know anything about the financials of this deal.
As I mentioned just a minute ago, there's been a slew of beer news coming our way in the last handful of months. Tell us what's going on. What kind of challenges are beer makers facing in this industry in Colorado?
In a moment of serendipity, really, last Tuesday, once this information about New Belgium came out, about an hour or two later, I was sitting down with other colleagues at Biz West in Boulder for our CEO roundtable, an event that we hold for specific industries for people to come together and kind of talk about what's going on in that industry. By sheer luck, we happened to have, you know, 9 or 10 brewers sitting around a table to kind of talk about this. And this was obviously the elephant in the room. This was a point of discussion and debate. It became somewhat clear to me that there is a lot of room in the brewing industry right now. If you are a small independent brewer that maybe runs one or two tap rooms and maybe does a little bit of self-distribution, but you're very locally focused. And there is room in the industry if you are an Anheuser-Busch or an SAB Miller, one of these big, super giant brewers. But the slowdown in craft consumption and craft growth has really hit the big regional brewers like New Belgium. And it seems like the main issue is distribution is very expensive, whether you do it through one of the big major distribution companies or you hire people to load up your kegs and drive them all around the place. It seems to be a real cash crunch in an industry where there's not a lot of price elasticity, which is a fancy economics term for saying that you can't really change the price of your beer that much. Generally, if you walk into a tap room, you expect to buy a beer for maybe $5 to $8, depending on if it's like a specialty run or something. But it's been $5 to $8 for most of the craft beer boom through the middle part of this decade. And now, as prices are rising and there's more and more competition, not just from other craft brewers, but from spiked seltzer makers and other alternative types of alcohol, it's a real price margin crunch for these big regional brewers who also happen to have to spend a lot of money on trying to get their beers to restaurants, to other bars, and to supermarkets.
On the consumer side of things, are beer sales still good? Are Coloradans still drinking as much beer as they always have?
I don't have statewide data, but I do know that the Brewers Association, which is the national trade group for independent brewers, said that in all of last year, the volume of craft beer produced rose by 4%. Now, that seems pretty good, but if you compare it to, say, 5 years ago in 2013, Brewers Association estimated that the growth rate for volume of craft beer produced was 18%, and it has steadily come down from that time, from 2013 and 2012, when craft brewing was really seen as this huge growth opportunity. In general, Americans are drinking less beer. And there are a lot of different factors to that, mainly going down to health. Just people don't want to drink as much alcohol. It's a lot of quote-unquote empty calories. Or they're looking for alternative ways to drink and get buzzed without the heaviness of beer and the calorie density of beer, which is why we're seeing wine in cans become more popular. Obviously, White Claw had its moment in the sun this summer. Whether or not that trend reverses in the near future, time will tell. But just in general, craft is still growing in terms of the amount of people wanting to get into the industry and people opening up breweries. But there is just so much saturation in the market and so much choice that the pie is getting bigger, as one brewer told me, but everyone's slice of the pie is just getting smaller.
Dan Micah is a reporter for BizWest. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
Of course.
Now let's take a look at today's headlines.
Thanksgiving can mean extra food and extra food waste. A new facility in the Mountain West sees a lot of potential in that waste, though. Wasatch Resource Recovery in Utah is taking in hundreds of tons of food waste and turning it into natural gas for energy. It does that through anaerobic digestion, basically teeny tiny bugs eating the stuff and excreting natural gas as a byproduct.
This Thanksgiving, an animal sanctuary in Erie is hosting a very different type of turkey dinner, where they're not on the menu. Love and Arms Animal Sanctuary will have a thanks and giving potluck where participants can hang out with their turkeys along with the rest of the farmyard animals. Sanctuary spokesperson Hannah Kircher says the event is aimed at showing appreciation for turkeys on a day when they don't normally get much.
A lot of people have never really met turkeys and they don't know, you know, how sweet and smart they are.
The free event will include a turkey meet and greet where attendees can feed the birds pumpkin treats and take pictures, followed by a potluck dinner. Out of respect for the sanctuary's residents, they request that all items brought to the potluck be vegan.
Northern Colorado is one of the state's fastest-growing regions, but where does it start and end? KUNC recently asked a few people to come into the office and draw where exactly they think Northern Colorado is, and the results were mixed. Here to tell us more is KUNC's Matt Bloom. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Henry.
So what gave you the idea for this project?
Well, I've been reporting and living in Colorado for 2 years now, and I've noticed that in my conversations with a lot of people, a lot of sources, that we refer to Northern Colorado all the time for where we live, where things happen. And I had this realization that I didn't really understand what people were talking about, what this region actually was. So I asked around, and there was actually a lot of disagreement between business owners, residents, public officials. So I put on my reporter cap and decided to find an answer.
And part of that answer involves video. Tell us more about that. Who came in and who drew a map of Northern Colorado for us?
We had six residents come to KUNC, all different ages, backgrounds, from five different communities. And we had them sit at a table and draw Northern Colorado on a map. We had a couple 10-year-olds named Blake and Ava come in.
A little anxious.
I'm excited.
They both had really broad definitions of what the region was. We also had a Loveland City Councilwoman, Kathy Wright, who had a really focused, tight definition.
They're projecting that NoCo is going to grow double in population, so that makes you look at it.
It was really fun, I have to say, to hear all these different perspectives.
Was there agreement about what places are definitely a part of Northern Colorado?
Yeah, there was some. Everybody at least included Fort Collins, Loveland, and Greeley. But that's pretty much where the agreement ended.
Tell us where the disagreement came in.
I'd say the most polarizing part for people was whether Boulder and some of the communities around Boulder, like Longmont, were part of Northern Colorado or not. And the second place where people had the most confusion, I guess, was how far south does Northern Colorado go? There's a lot of gray area.
And you invited in the state demographer. What did she have to say?
Yes, we needed an expert to be our judge of this. Elizabeth Gardner had a very concrete, data-driven definition of Northern Colorado.
Counties have the best level of data, and so that's how we have always worked with what we call Region 2. Northern Colorado is Larimer and Weld.
You might never hear somebody refer to us as Region 2. I mean, I would never say I live in Region 2 of Colorado, but that's how the state defines us.
Why does it matter where Northern Colorado really is?
We need some of these boundaries to project population growth. That's what Elizabeth says. There's about 600,000 new people expected to move to Colorado by 2050. That's a bunch of people. And having that information helps inform some of the decisions made in local governments, like transportation planning, you know, school planning, all that sorts of stuff. You need to have a sense of where the region is headed, but also just knowing what other people might be referring to when they say Northern Colorado is really helpful in the conversations we have every day at school, at work, or at home.
Did anyone get the map of Northern Colorado right?
There was one favorite that Elizabeth had, but I'm not going to spoil it. So you're going to have to go to our website and watch the video to find out.
All right. Matt Bloom is a reporter for KUNC. His video project, Drawing NoCo, is available on our website, like Matt said, KUNC.org. Thanks for coming in, Matt.
Always a pleasure.
And if you want to avoid a contentious conversation about politics at your Thanksgiving table this year, you can find a map of Colorado to print at our website. Maybe print it off and argue with your family and friends about where they think Northern Colorado is. But if you must talk about politics, we do have some tips coming up.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.
There have been no impeachment hearings this week, but people are still talking about it. And unless your family has a policy explicitly barring talk of politics or other divisive subjects, the topic is likely to come up around the Thanksgiving table.
And if that thought fills you with dread, relax. We're about to dish up some advice for how to have civil discourse so you can help avoid hurt feelings or possibly a food fight during the holidays. Here to help us out is Martine Karkason, director of the CSU Center for Public Deliberation. Martine, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just dive right in. There are a lot of potential landmines this holiday. Impeachment, of course, but there's also the upcoming 2020 election, climate change. That's just to name a few. And that kind of conversation can be really stimulating, but it can also go off the rails really quickly. So what advice would you give for keeping dialogue civil?
I think the first thing I would say is to really going into it thinking about what you're actually trying to accomplish. If your goal is really to try to change people's minds that think a lot differently than you, I would probably recommend to rethink that. The more we know about social psychology and kind of how divided we are, if your goal is to really debate and try to win people over, it's likely to probably backfire and go badly. So I think going into the conversation with some different goals, you know, more of just focusing on creating a little bit more understanding, you get a chance to, you know, talk about some big issues, to talk about kind of values, but probably stay away from specific things that you're going to get into kind of fact wars and those, because those are probably not going to go very well.
Politics may not even come up at all, but, you know, for some families, that kind of conversation is very stimulating, or they like to have a spirited debate. So how would you maybe recognize and stop a conversation before it goes too far?
What we're finding more and more, again, going back to the social psychology, is the more we understand how our brains work, I think that gives us some things to talk about. You know, so I think one way, instead of trying to dive into the issues, just to get people to respond to that, to think about how to talk about polarization as the topic, right? To talk, because I think there's actually a lot of common ground there. We're getting more and more from the polls of people that are just more and more frustrated with the inability to talk to each other and kind of talking past each other. So steering the conversation to that, of like, how do we learn how to talk to each other? What do we need to do to be able to do that? I think might give you the chance to talk about some of those kind of bigger issues, but framing it in a different way instead of figuring out what side's right or wrong or those type of things. It gives you a common task to work on of how do we learn how to talk to each other again.
And I wanted to come back to something you just mentioned, and this reminds me of another person in my family who's very politically engaged, and she believes very strongly if she just lays out the facts, here's what's going on, that she will eventually win people over to her side of the argument. Just wondered what your thoughts are on that approach.
I think the social science is becoming more and more clear that facts don't change people's minds, particularly in a kind of polarized environment. But within a primarily kind of adversarial kind of frame, and obviously our national politics is a very basic adversarial frame. There's two teams, a red team and a blue team, and we know within that context facts don't work, right? Facts are used as ammunition as they fit your side, or you can kind of dismiss them as fake news if they don't. And we actually now even learning more and more that in some ways the stronger your facts are, the more they might backfire when you're trying to convince someone who thinks differently, because they're still going to be able to find some sort of flaw in the argument. And really, at the end of the conversation, they'll just feel like, you know, they thought they had this great information, and even that was not good enough, you know. So I think we need to get away from thinking the facts are going to do what we want them to do and kind of win the day, in a sense. At the same time, we don't want to give up on facts, right? You know, so that's a lot of the work that we do is, like, how do we change the kind of conversations we have so facts matter again? I just think in a context of a couple hours and a dinner over Thanksgiving, it's going to be really hard to change that broader kind of conversation. So I think aiming a little lower and saying, I'm not going to try to change people's minds. I'm just going to try to kind of understand people.
Lastly, do you have any tips for listening? Because it's very clear that if you're going to have these kind of discussions and civil dialogue, you really need to listen.
We tend not to get trained to listen, right? And our natural inclination to listen, particularly with people that disagree with us, is to kind of look for flaws, right? Or look for something to kind of expose and jump on. And certainly that kind of listening is not going to lead to a very good conversation at Thanksgiving. You know, so really listening to understand, you know, giving them the benefit of the doubt, trying to kind of understand what's important to them, both is going to help the conversation. It's also pretty pragmatic, right? If you ultimately want to change their mind, right, really kind of listening to where they're coming from and what's important to them is going to be pretty critical for you to, down the line, really kind of make the arguments that you need to make to get them to think a little bit differently, in a sense. So again, asking kind of why is this important to them and kind of pulling that out can be critical.
And then what if we have a disagreement over whether green bean casserole is good or bad? Where do you fall?
I'm on the pro-green bean casserole kind of camp, certainly.
I am too. Maybe that's something we all can agree on. I don't know.
Yeah, that's the always, if all else fails, just kind of, you know, shift to the food or what's the best pie or something like that. Right?
All right. Martine Carcassonne is a professor in the communications department at Colorado State University and the director of the CSU Center for Public Deliberation. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you.
One way you could pull people together is to gather around the radio to listen to what has become a family tradition for some.
You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant.
On Thanksgiving, radio stations around the country will play Arlo Guthrie's 1967 song, Alice's Restaurant. But why is this 18-minute song, which is ostensibly about littering and Vietnam, considered a Thanksgiving song? Here to explain is Margot from KUNC's sister station, The Colorado Sound, and host of the weekly music history show, Music 101. Hi, Margot.
Hi, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
So for listeners who aren't familiar with the song, I mean, it is very unique. Can you start by describing it for us?
Alice's Restaurant is a song that is based on a true story of something that happened to Arlo Guthrie and his friend Rick Robbins, who's also a musician. They were home for Thanksgiving, and they were hanging out with their friend Alice. Alice is a true person.
Okay.
And they had a big Thanksgiving dinner at this church where Alice lived. She kind of made the church a sanctuary for people who were of like minds that perhaps were surrounded in a city of people who are not of like minds.
Mm.
My nice way of saying they were hippies and freaks. And
I was going to ask.
Yes.
Okay.
And so a lot of people would hang out there. And Alice had a big Thanksgiving dinner. And Arlo and his friend Rick decided the next morning it would be really nice to help Alice clean up.
Mm.
So they did. They put in everything that they could fit into Arlo's VW bus to take to the town dump.
To take the garbage down to the city dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction and headed on toward the city dump.
Very thoughtful.
And yes, and once they got to the dump, they found the dump was closed.
Mm.
So they thought, well, we have this VW full of trash. What should we do with it? Oh, here's an existing pile of trash. We'll just add it to that.
What could be the harm?
Right. So that's what they did.
At the bottom of the cliff was another pile of garbage. And we decided that one big pile is better than two little piles. And rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. That's what we did.
And the next day, they were visited by the chief of police, and he cited them for littering, and they had to appear in court. And Arlo Guthrie was found guilty of this tragic offense of littering, and interestingly enough, because he had a record, he was no longer eligible for the draft in Vietnam. So he never had to go.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. All right. And so, of course, this takes place on Thanksgiving. But, you know, again, it really doesn't have anything to do with the holiday. Was this song originally considered, I mean, something else that seems like a protest song?
To be truthful, there wasn't a lot of attention paid to the song at first.
Oh.
But then Arlo was invited to appear on a radio station in New York called WBAI, plays Alice's Restaurant Live. And of course, it's 18 and a half minutes long.
Yeah.
But people loved it. They thought it was the greatest song. And they started calling in WBAI and requesting Alice's Restaurant. And of course, they couldn't have Arlo come in and play it live every time.
Right.
So, and the true title of Alice's Restaurant, I should add, is Alice's Restaurant Massacre. And that's how you say it, Massacre.
Massacre. What is Massacre? What does that mean?
Arlo Guthrie explained it at one time. He said, it's a series of absurd events. So the Alice's Restaurant movement is against absurdity and in favor of reason. And listeners love that idea. And so what WBAI started doing was using Alice's Restaurant Massacre as a pledge drive thing. If you give us money during, because they're a public non-commercial radio station.
Right.
If you give us money during our pledge drives, we'll play Alice's Restaurant Massacre.
Wow. And so that worked.
And that worked. And it morphed into a Thanksgiving tradition because it takes place on Thanksgiving. And there are no Thanksgiving songs.
No.
Think about it. There aren't any.
I can't think of one, really.
No, you can't.
People have been citing the Adam Sandler song, the Thanksgiving song.
Well, the Thanksgiving song isn't really, that's not going to be a tradition on the Colorado Sound because it doesn't touch people the way Arlo Guthrie's Alice's Restaurant Massacre does.
Right.
The idea, it's such an absurd thing to have happened to these two guys who are trying to do such a nice thing. And if you really think about it, one of the reasons that we all know they were cited is because they were hippies.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so I think that touches a chord with people, but I also think people like traditions. And Thanksgiving is nothing if not about tradition.
Absolutely.
So once WBAI started playing this on Thanksgiving, other radio stations across the country started getting requests from people who moved from New York City and knew of this tradition to their radio stations.
Oh.
So that's how radio stations started playing Alice's Restaurant Massacre on Thanksgiving.
Okay.
It was kind of an organic movement.
Well, we were searching around a little bit and we found this interview with Arlo Guthrie talking to NPR in 2005. And here is what he said about the song.
It became an underground thing, not just here, but, you know, everywhere, with guys on all sides of the struggles over there and the struggles that were going on here. And it overcame, it actually became now, really, it's a Thanksgiving ballad more than an anti-war this or a pro that or whatever it was. And I think it could only happen here.
And so I thought it was kind of interesting to get his take on that. What do you make of that? I mean, about this transitioning from a protest song into a Thanksgiving song.
I think Arlo Guthrie was really surprised by the success of Alice's Restaurant. And as most songs do, they change with the times. Think of your favorite song.
Okay.
Think of a song that you truly love and it meant something to you at one time in your life. Now think about how that song means to you 20, 30, 40 years down the road. The feeling, the kernel of that feeling is still there, but the idea of the song in your mind has changed a bit. Alice's Restaurant is the same thing. And I think Arlo Guthrie, you know, when times change, songs can fit to the changing times.
And the best songs, I think, have that kind of all-encompassing lyric where people can put their own meaning onto it.
So now I don't think the song that Arlo, as he sang it in 1967, means so much like the man's ridiculous as it means more to my dad listened to this. And so I listened to this on Thanksgiving. And now my children will listen to this on Thanksgiving. As the years pass, the meaning changes and it becomes different for each family. I think that's what he's referring to.
And just so you don't miss it, if you want to hear Alice's Restaurant tomorrow, tune into the Colorado Sound when?
At noon. Every year at noon, the Colorado Sound without fail will air Alice's Restaurant. But I will say everybody's watches are different, so tune in about a minute early to noon so you don't miss any of Alice's Restaurant.
Margo is a music host for 105.5 The Colorado Sound. Margo, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant, excepting Alice. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. So walk right in.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Colorado Edition's Thanksgiving special, we'll take a look back at some of our favorite stories KUNC told this year. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.